about it is the Warrior Connection. Respect, education, information is what you're going to get from Warrior Connection. Dr. Gary Noll made this decision many years ago, and we've all been involved, and we continue to do it and make a big difference. Well, we're going to continue to discuss medical research and medical treatment, what's coming up. Denise, would you like to introduce our guests and what we're going to hear today?
Yes, we're going to hear about a research program for a suggested treatment on GFOR illness. And I've got about five questions that we're going to go through first, and then we'll branch out from there, coming back to those topics. But Julia, would you introduce yourself and your credentials and where you're from?
Certainly. Hi, Denise and Doug. My name is Julia Golier. I am a physician. My main job is I'm a clinician and administrator as the chief of psychiatry at the James J. Peter VA Medical Center. I am also an associate professor at the Icahn School of Medicine. And I have been involved in Gulf War and PTSD research for the last 10 or 20 years.
I want to welcome you to the program. I've been busy setting up other researchers to talk to us. What is the reason that you got involved in a GFOR illness situation? What have you seen? What drew you to it?
That's very interesting. I started at the VA actually doing first schizophrenia research and then post-traumatic stress disorder research. There was a time when post-traumatic stress disorder was not as widely accepted a diagnosis as it is today. And I was here in the 90s when treatments for PTSD were just catching on and research was underway, and it was a pretty exciting time. And after the Gulf War, I was here, and people kept referring me veterans who served to the Gulf War to my PTSD program. And sure enough, some of them would have insomnia or concentration problems or memory problems, but the majority of them didn't have PTSD, even though they were referred to me. So I became increasingly interested in what had happened to these men and women, so many of whom had sharp declines in memory functioning or physical functioning. And this was really at the just at the end of the war, and so many people came back with so many health symptoms and unanswered questions that I just couldn't help but get involved in trying to sort out what was going on.
Yeah, just for the listeners, I think the rates that have been shown by our researchers and with the RAC committee, the VA Research Advisory Committee on GFOR Illness Research, is they were talking about maybe 10% of us GFOR veterans having PTSD. And we really did not have the traumatic brain injuries that our current group that's following us as OIF and OEF had. Now, let's take a few minutes, and please describe the research study that you're doing.
I'm currently doing several and have been doing several. The most, I think, exciting one that I'm currently working on is a study of, is a treatment study. It's a treatment study of intranasal insulin in the treatment of Gulf War illness. So I think most of your listeners know what Gulf War illness is, but it is worth just, I think it bears repeating that many veterans came back with unexplained medical symptoms. They fall along the lines of fatigue, widespread pain, joint pain, depression, concentration problems, mood symptoms. At first it was a question of whether or not this is psychological or psychiatric. But as more and more research became available, it was clear that it was kind of a distinct syndrome. It occurs after other wars, but not with the frequency or intensity as we saw in the Gulf War veterans. I think the exciting thing about this treatment is that there's always a question with such a broad array of symptoms that Gulf War veterans have, you know, where do you start? Do you start with the fatigue, the joint pain, the headaches? Do you do it based on symptoms or based on sort of underlying pathophysiology? And this study really mostly targets the cognitive symptoms, the memory and attention deficits that you see in Gulf War veterans with chronic multi-symptom illness.
Okay. Tell us a little bit more about, you know, if you get into this study, we're going to talk about those that qualify or don't qualify in a minute, but this treatment study on the intranasal insulin, why did you choose that treatment method?
Okay, that's an excellent question, and there are basically two reasons having to do with mechanism, and another reason having to do with just how insulin has performed in other studies. Let me start with the other studies first. Intranasal insulin there's some evidence that it is effective in improving verbal memory and preventing cognitive decline in Alzheimer's disease, which is a severe neurodegenerative disease. Obviously, that is not what Gulf War illness is, but if you can improve memory and attention in Alzheimer's disease, then it's worth considering whether or not you can improve cognitive symptoms in Gulf War illness. It's also actually been shown to improve memory in normal adults. The brain has insulin receptors. By using the intranasal route, the insulin can get into the brain. It travels through the olfactory bulb into the surrounding brain tissue and cerebrospinal fluid and bypasses the whole systemic circulation, so it can go direct in terms of helping to facilitate cognition. The two mechanisms reason why we think it might be mechanistically helpful in Gulf War illness has to do with the exposures that Gulf War veterans had, as well as some of the studies that I've done, or our lab has done, on the stress system in Gulf War veterans. A lot of the, some of the exposures implicated in Gulf War chronic multi-symptom illness are pyridostigmine bromide exposure and pesticide exposure, and those are believed to have contributed to an overall neuroinflammation in veterans with CMI, and insulin has been shown to sort of decrease inflammation in the brain. So mechanistically, one reason we think insulin can help with Gulf War veterans with chronic multi-symptom illness is to reduce the inflammation that we think is contributing to symptoms. The other reason, mechanistically, is because of work we have done showing abnormalities in the endocrine system. As I mentioned in the beginning, I was originally working in post-traumatic stress disorder, where we had different probes of the body's stress response and identified some unique profiles in Gulf War veterans showing this kind of exaggerated response to stress. Well, insulin, again, there are receptors in the brain, when administered intranasally, decreases this sort of exaggerated and damaging response to stressors. So those are the two mechanistic reasons that we think it could be helpful for Gulf War veterans.
This is excellent because it's explaining in a language I think that Gulf War veterans or their spouses can understand. Now, on the studies you mentioned with the using it with Alzheimer's or normal adults, do you know the numbers that were involved in those studies, roughly? Were there large numbers?
Currently, there were decent-sized numbers. In the normal adults, there were small numbers, like in the 20s and 30s. I don't have the exact numbers, but in the Alzheimer's, you know, I'm thinking maybe 100, but I would have to fact check that. But it's an exciting enough approach that there's currently a major multi-site national study going underway to like finally address the question in Alzheimer's, because it's a pretty important possibility if you could improve you can improve functioning in Alzheimer's disease. So
I think it's an excellent study, and I reference back to the encounters I've had going through this as a Gulf War veteran nurse with a master's degree, is early on when we were having Congressman Shea's government reform and oversight hearing, meeting with his general counsel, and Dr. Kahn was, you know, we were bringing out that this is almost like an early stage, early age group Alzheimer's that we were seeing. It was very pronounced to me as I got more and more involved of our veterans that had college degrees and were struggling to even hold a job at McDonald's and to watch their writing when they emailed me of, you know, things I could pick up that just didn't seem to jive. So I think it's an excellent program. How many have you, are you trying to get in total into the study?
So I do want to, I do, on the one hand, I like the comparison in terms of the severity of symptoms that you're seeing, but I also don't want to scare people who might take that to mean that we think that Gulfware illness is like Alzheimer's. That I don't think we think. That there are sort of plaques and tangles that are involved in Alzheimer's disease that is unique to that condition. So
But that was the closest,
I think
when you're trying to describe it.
Right.
It was kind of close, but not exact.
Exactly. But what you're saying is that you have seen profound neurologic symptoms in people. And their memory,
And their memory, and based on their prior to the war abilities and education and after the war, and having family members that have talked to me about how significant the changes have been. You know, you search for a wording that people can identify to. So that was the closest wording that we could try to identify to, although we knew it was not, you know, exact, and probably shouldn't use that wording, and that's why we use memory, neurocognitive difficulties, those type things. But it's
and I agree, that was what was, when you asked what got me involved, that was the most striking aspect. I mean, there were a lot of people that also, you know, came back with pain syndromes, but it was really the cognitive change, you know, seeing apparent cognitive changes in people who were relatively young, you know, prior to the war and well-functioning, that really got my attention. And
well,
you know,
as
there was an area of concern.
Former nurse at that level, my concern is, number one, is the health care and getting them back to some kind of functional status close to what they were before the war or what would normally be considered now with our age group. So, you know, the quality of life and improving things that can help them, and the cognitive memory problems is significant. I think we can find ways to deal with pain. Fatigue is another problem. But the neurocognitive, you know, they even need so much more help with their working with their own physicians and being able to communicate in a good patient-doctor relationship and being able to express their needs and what they're thinking without getting angry. I call our PTSD more induced by VA. But anyway, it's significant there. And if we could improve that one area, it would make a difference with their quality of living for their families. And maybe, you know, being able to, you know, have some kind of work or a vocation that they can enjoy instead of just feeling lost and feeling disconnected because of the neurocognitive problems.
I think
they have problems dealing with their own claims. It's really hard. I compliment you for trying to find something to help them. Now, how many are you trying to recruit, and how many do you currently have recruited already?
Okay, we need to, we have about 20. We need to recruit 114 across two sites. And you know, it's a challenge in the sense that Gulf War veterans are a finite population. You know, I mean, other diseases, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder or other, you know, repeat themselves over multiple cycles. But this is such a unique condition in a defined population that, you know, recruitment is a challenge. This has been true of just about all Gulf War studies. So
where are your two sites?
It's a challenge. So our two sites are the Bronx and Boston. So, I mean, the Bronx is accessible to people who live in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, you know, depending on their ability to get around, and also Boston. Maxine Kringle, who you know, is the PI is a local investigator in Boston, and I am the site investigator here in the Bronx.
I'm going to move right along here, and then we can come back to some of those areas that we need to. And Doug can participate at that point. I'm trying to get some basics out. Now, if they're traveling, are they supported as far as helping them travel to get to the site? What is involved? How many visits? That kind of information.
In general, I mean, there were grants in the early years of you know, Gulf War studies where people would go to certain war-related injury sites and have overnight travel and so forth. That is not something we really built in. There is a finite budget. So, you know, mostly we're working with people who we think can travel on their own. There's a total of 7 visits over 12 weeks. You know, you were talking about the neurocognitive, and I agree it's important, and certainly that's what the RAC has said. You know, the brain and needs to be the target organ for treatments because that's what we think has been impacted by the various exposures. So we test for executive functioning, tests of attention, motor function, visual-spatial skills, memory, motivation. So a person gets a complete sort of neuropsychological test battery so we can characterize their current mental status and see if we can improve memory and attention. So that
okay,
gets done at baseline.
Probably
and again,
one visit
at,
for
at
sure
endpoint.
On that.
Yeah, I know, yeah. We try and we do a focused interview. We do a focused set of tests, but that definitely can take some time.
Now, are you measuring that after they have the 12 weeks?
Exactly. So that, I mean, that's one of the interesting questions is, you know, so in Gulf War veterans, when you're trying to help people, what are your main outcomes? Are they the health symptoms? Is it wellness? Is it functioning? Is it cognitive status? In the end, we look at all of those things. But when you define a clinical trial, you have to sort of state what you believe is the main focus, your main outcome, and our main outcome is to see if we can improve memory and
so
attention.
You're testing before and after, I would assume.
Correct, yep.
Okay. Is your funding through VA or through the CDMRP program with DOD?
The funding in terms of the specifics of this study are from the DOD and the CDMRP, but of course I'm a VA, a full-time VA physician, so in that regard it's also supported by the VA.
Right. I want to make that clear to our audience and to the veterans. We have two sources of funding. One is VA, which is limited to those that are VA researchers. Then we have the DOD CDMRP that is open worldwide to researchers to put in their proposals. We do not shut out the VA researchers. So it's kind of a different way of doing it with our DOD funding. And I just wanted to point that out is that the VA-funded ones primarily fund just VA researchers and not outside of the VA. So that's important, I think, for people to understand. My next question has to do with, are there any people, I know you probably have a call-in interview and we'll talk about contact info next, but are there any people that would not qualify for this study?
That's a good question. The main exclusions are really, it's kind of tricky. You haven't, is if people have really, you know, major other medical disorders. Diabetes would be exclusionary. You know, if you have, you know, God forbid, cancer or, you know, a really severe TBI or partly because those conditions could, you know, be contributing to the symptoms. But the main exclusions have to do with the sort of severe medical comorbidities.
Okay. Any drugs that would disqualify them? Like, you know, I'd automatically think about chemotherapy drugs that could alter all this.
Right.
But any other drugs that you look at as being, we don't want to include those?
Mm-hmm. The main, there are very few. If someone is taking insulin, then we're not going to put them in a study of intranasal insulin. And also anyone who is taking steroids, oral steroids.
That makes sense. Now, any if they also have PTSD, how about that?
That is not exclusionary. In fact, there is also a study, or there's a proposal. I don't think it's actually turned into a study. There is also a proposal to look at intranasal insulin in PTSD for similar reasons. There's some glucocorticoid reactivity, some, you know, memory problems in PTSD. So no, it's not exclusionary. We also, I mean, it's not a main outcome measure because, you know, most of our participants won't have full-blown PTSD, though some may have some symptoms. So we look at it as a sort of a tertiary outcome measure, but it's not a primary outcome measure.
Okay. We're going to do this several times, but for the first time, the people that need to call in to get into the study that are interested, give the contact info, and we'll do that a couple more times through the program.
Okay. All right. There's two contacts here in the Bronx, and we actually have some other studies involving Gulf War veterans. Is to contact myself or my coordinator, Brendan Bouchard. That number is 718-584-9000, extension 6587. Again, that's Dr. Golier or Brendan Bouchard, who himself is a veteran, at 718-584-9000, extension 6587, and that's in the Bronx. Alternatively, if you are in the Boston area, a contact is Dr. Maxine Krengel, who also has been extremely committed to the study of Gulf War veterans from the very beginning. Her number is 857-364-6933. Again, Maxine Krengel, 857-364-6933.
Okay, is there an email address?
My email is Julia Golier. Well, here, let me give you my VA. Is Julia.Golier, Golier, at va.gov, G-O-V. So julia.golier at va.gov. And, you know, whether you're in Boston or the New York area, you know, you can email me.
Okay, and you'll get them to the Boston side if they need
to.
Okay, Doug. Doug Roeke?
Yeah, we're right here. This is fascinating because, Julia, as Denise knows, and part of what we got involved in with Denise and I and our team got involved, we had confirmed exposures, because our team was the ones in the middle of all of it doing the worst of the worst confirmed exposures. And Denise has met them and everything, and this memory, the neuropsychology is one of the most significant things that we've had happening.
Mm-hmm.
And Dante or Rollo, what they call it is, who am I, how did I get here, why am I here, and what am I supposed to do? And what we found out when we went up to the Warren Drew Clinic and Kelly did the neuropsychological testing on us, you know, the memory data bank as far as names and numbers and movements and everything just had, I mean, severely, I mean, just deteriorated completely to verbally nothing. But all of us were getting lost. And say, for example, my sergeant, who I did all this stuff with, and he's pretty famous, he, Rollo Dolph, he was Schwarzkopf's personal medic. We went some time ago, went to pick up a CB antenna, and the antenna was literally across the yard from his grandparents' house. Well, we came in, and we turned right, and then we turned left, and then we turned left again to go to the house. And if you go into his grandparents, you came in, turned left, and then turned right, and went right down the street, and then his grandparents' there. So when we were sitting there getting the antenna down, you could literally see his grandparents' house. And he got lost. He didn't know where he was or how to get out of it. And he had literally gone into this neighborhood his entire life, and his grandparents were still there, and he was lost. Other team members, our colonel and his wife complains about all the time, we'll literally be downstairs and go to get something. Remember, we need to get something upstairs, and we go upstairs, and it's gone. What we've seen and what I've happened to myself, and this has happened more than once, and Denise has been there right with me when I really crashed at CDC, is the switch goes off and then the switch comes back on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this neuropsychology, the memory function and all this other stuff and the inflammation is absolutely significant because
right.
As a college professor, what I found out, here's these students really dedicated to learning, and they can't do it. And they're brilliant. Mm-hmm. They're very bright. But when we go mm-hmm. to take a test at the end of a unit chapter or something or to recall it, the short-term memory is gone. Mm-hmm. A long-term memory in some length like that, it might be embedded and you can trigger it and get it back out.
Exactly.
But we're seeing an absolute nightmare. Personally, I was in my final semester of my PhD when I went to Desert Storm, and we totally got zapped, know exactly what came back, and I'm God bless it. I didn't have to take my qualifying exams because I had done them before, or mm-hmm. there's no doubt in my mind that it wouldn't have made it. What I saw as a college professor at Jacksonville State outside of Port McClellan here at the University of Illinois, the students' learning abilities and everything else, so they're totally capable, but the neurophysiology of all this stuff, short-term memory and movement problems and pain and everything is so aggravating that the student gets frustrated and gives up and then walks away, and then they're sitting there left with nothing.
Hmm. But that really gives life to the literature, which is, you know, which describes this in a sort of a data way, but that really gives life to what it's like day to day for people, Gulf War veterans who continue to suffer with persistent neurocognitive deficits.
Yeah, Julia, all along the way, and I have to admit, I got disoriented in Denver, where I've lived for 20-something years now, and, you know, in broad daylight. And here you've got to the west over the mountains. You can see them. The east is, you know, away from the mountains. And I got totally disoriented a number of times, and that's very concerning. We've had vets do that. All along the way, I have reports mm-hmm. from early on as I stepped out, put my name and phone number out in the 90s, early 90s, hearing their stories, talking to their spouses, their family members.
Mm-hmm.
The IQ level, I've always said maybe you should measure that if there was an IQ level ever made before. It would be interesting to have that.
Mm-hmm.
The neuropsych exams need to be, you know, really... You know, I know that every study has a little neuropsych screening, as I call it. The registries do not do that at the VA. The comprehensive clinical eval that was done with the DOD early on did some of that. Like I said, each study does it. I, you know, went to to a neuropsych civilian that is considered an expert in environmental exposure. She's even dealt with one herself and had to battle back to health in order to continue her practice. And the complete neuropsych testing takes, you know, usually two sessions,
mm-hmm. right.
Because it's very tiring. But we did it in one day, and it was a 12-hour day. And, you know, what I saw in myself, sitting down with my daughter as she was growing up and helping her with math homework, you know, I was struggling. Right. I had to step out of nursing, and I was teaching at a college level, and I'd go blank. You know, it was shut off in the middle of the lecture, and I'd have to kind of compensate in some way. You know, wake up a sleeping student and go, okay, what was I saying? Anybody want to help her?
I had that happen after the CDC, and Denise was pretty, I was pretty bad when I crashed and burned, and I got back, and I had to go teach a lecture that day that I came back, and I was so sick, and I started talking, and the student stopped me and said, Doug, you need to go home and go to bed. This is not making any sense. And it's truly frightening, because I think what we're learning and what you're describing and how you've described the pathophysiology of this stuff is a little dabble do you. So the old thing of 1 + 1 = 2, but we're seeing an incredibly synergistic response into the brain and throughout the body, where 1 + 1 + 1 ends up with a neurotoxicity of like 5 or 7 or 9. So these very small levels of exposures are synergistic, and what they just did is seem to really totally affect this whole thing, because I think where you're looking at is probably the most frustrating part for everybody that I encounter. Mm-hmm. Their short-term memory problems, their pain problems, trying to remember a name. I mean, we've all had the problem. Denise had been right there where I couldn't even remember my family names.
Yeah.
Well, I think you had Dr. Sullivan on in within the last month, and as you know, she's quite expert on the exposures, but certainly, you know, there is, you know, when you all first came back, there was a laundry list of potential exposures, and you know, how do you model what actually happened? How do you account for multiple exposures, and if something, you know, isn't dangerous at a high dose, but if you have multiple exposures at a lower dose, or lower dose plus stress, or lower dose plus heat, you know, how does it all come together? And as you know, a lot of the studies rely on self-report data, which is not perfect. You don't know dose, you can't confirm, but it's, you know, it's pretty strong evidence that pyridostigmine, bromide, and pesticides are contributing to these neurocognitive symptoms. And
it's,
I know you mentioned
same,
depleted uranium.
We're talking
a question
about a treatment
of what
trial.
Right. So this is right. So, but one of the mechanisms by which it's believed that these, you know, toxins exert their effect is through neuronal injury, and then the neuronal injury causing an inflammatory response. And so that's what we're really trying to target with the insulin. You can't undo the exposure, but can you decrease the inflammation that's going on today to improve function? Same with the HPA axis. We've done studies in Gulf War veterans showing this exaggerated HPA axis. Will the insulin quiet the HPA axis as it does in other situations to the response to stress that can help improve memory and homeostasis? So that is our hope with this study.
Julia, are you going to be doing a follow-up? My concern is you do it for 12 weeks. What you say, 7 visits or...
Mm-hmm.
Do we do a follow-up with them in 6 months to see if this, if there's an improvement, if it's lasting, you know, 6 months, a year down the road?
This current study does not have a follow-up built in, but that might be something that we can add in down the road.
I think that needs to be looked at instead of, you know, we do a treatment study and we show improvement at the end, But is it a lasting?
Sustained, right.
Sustained at 1 year, 2 years, 5 years. Did it make a difference? That is my big concern, is we're moving into treatment trials, and I think some of them are excellent ideas. But we need to see that we don't do just a spot check, you know, after 12 weeks. You know, is this sustainable, or do you need further treatment with it?
Right.
Hey, Ray, so, are you there? What are we been seeing on the active duty at Capital's Union as they come back? Are we seeing these memory problems and movement problems and everything there, or is it getting, is it aggravated, or does it seem to be worse in one way or another?
Doug, I usually, and Dr. Goldie, I'm honored to be with you today and listen to what you're doing. It's very fascinating. But I work with Marines at Camp Lejeune a lot, and we do see a lot of it where it has a, you know, they're losing their memories and things, and they can't. And a lot of people, it's confusing sometimes with moral injury sometimes that causes a person to not remember, or you know, they don't want to go back or something. And I talk a lot with these Marines about the rearview mirror. And but what I think what you're talking about is the chemical exposures that had a, an effect on them that I don't think we've ever seen this before in the numbers that you have. But, you know, I've always looked at Vietnam veterans as, I mean, I myself, Doug and Denise are too, but I was affected in a lot of ways of where I shut down, wouldn't talk about things and all because of the moral ramifications of what we did. But I think what you're talking about is a whole different thing of the exposure to toxic and biological that we never had presence for that before. Mm-hmm. And so you're working in a whole different ball game.
Right.
And you've opened my eyes to several things today. And so, but I'm watching these young men and women deteriorate before your very eyes. And you wonder what kind of future they might have.
And we see it in their writing skills, you know, not only, you know, memory and loss, visual perception problems, getting lost, you know, the direct memory they should still be able to retain. For example, I have a tremendous example from one of my vets. He had to quit driving trucks. I had more than one on this one, commercial truck driving, and had to give up that employment because he was getting lost. Also, the wife called, I'm not using names to protect her identity, but she was in tears one day, and I said, well, what's going on? And she had woken up, and her husband was into her purse, into her billfold, and she asked him why. And this was a couple that had been married over 20 years, and he said, I couldn't remember your name, so I was looking for your driver's license.
Oh,
and, you know, one of my things that comes out of this study is not only a treatment trial and looking at long-term effects, but I think of another area that we have a problem with, and I think it's important to point out to VA, all the people involved, is that with our claims, we have presumptives for chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, irritable bowel. We have other symptoms listed, but it's harder to get those presumptives, really hard. Mm-hmm. And so the neuropsych evals are not being done, and I think that should be a priority with our vets, is complete neuropsych, you know, not just the short ones that are typically given in a couple of hours, but a complete one. And I look at benefits because this has impacted our employability. It impacts holding a job. And vets have spoken to that, but it's very hard to get a claim through specifically on that. So there's an area on benefits, compensation for these vets until we find treatment. Hopefully if they improved, you know, it would help. On care and returning to life and quality of life, but also on the benefit side on claims. But in the meantime, they're suffering, and they're not able to hold a job. And, you know, this would be one thing that we could have a DBQ on the neurocognitive damage, specifically for the Gulf War, that I think needs to be looked at. I have another question. You referred to you had other studies going on, and I want to stay specific for the Gulf War vets, but if you want to mention those from the Bronx VA.
Certainly. Actually, these are, in fact, in Gulf War veterans. There's another, so this is obviously, treatment study is our biggest priority because of, what you've just described, and, people aren't getting any younger and they need help now. And so our overwhelming priority is on getting this treatment study, well situated. And for that, we really need a lot of Gulf War veterans in the area to, get involved and see if they can get friends or associates to help, because all the funding in the world doesn't help if you can't get the numbers. And so we appreciate your giving us this platform, not just to educate, but to also try to hopefully
recruit,
motivate people to recruit. The other study, is part of the reason how I got into this, of course, had to do with mechanism and finding, multiple studies in an abnormal hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis or stress axis in Gulf War veterans. And the study that I'm looking at now is trying to understand, so we have found that there's this exaggerated stress response in Gulf War veterans, and that is linked to self-described pyridostigmine bromide exposure. So it's linked in terms of exposure. But what does that mean for health? And so we are currently continuing to do studies looking at the cortisol response to stress and how it impacts medical markers. We're doing a test where we look at the oral glucose tolerance test to see whether or not people have impaired glucose tolerance if they're at increased risk for diabetes. We're looking at other biomarkers of Gulf War veterans. And actually, if you are not a Gulf War veteran, or if you are not deployed to the Gulf, it's equally important for that study to have people who served at the same time and weren't exposed to the Gulf, because we're always trying to tease out what was the biological and medical consequences of deployment versus what are the correlates of actually developing chronic multi-symptom illness. It's two important questions. So for that study, we need Gulf War veterans both with chronic multi-symptom illness and without chronic multi-symptom illness, as well as men and women who served around the same time who were not deployed to the Gulf, so we can sort of distinguish, what was the environment and what's related to illness, and look at biomarkers of Gulf War illness and Gulf War deployment. Lastly, we will be a site in...
Well, before we go to lastly,
okay.
Is that one of your studies too, or is there another contact point?
No, that would be, again, you would want to call Brendan Bouchard.
Okay, same number.
That's a single site study in the Bronx, 718-584-9000, extension 6587. And that's to basically look at, mechanisms underlying Gulf War illness and Gulf War deployment.
And how many visits would that involve for the person?
That's about four. They go to Mount Sinai. They have a basic assessment, have a glucose tolerance test done, which is you just take glucose and we measure your insulin response, your cortisol response, your glucose response, and a test of some other markers. It's not a big commitment, but it's important data. Yeah.
Okay, and we'll move on to the second study.
And finally, we have a lot going on here. This is Nancy Klimas' study based on work done by Beatrice Galum. So here we're a site. We didn't instigate this, but in the spring we will be looking at coenzyme Q10 which is a supplement you probably heard about that
right.
is believed to improve immune function. And we're just getting that up and running. Again, intranasal insulin.
I think that would be five sites in the VA system, if I remember correctly.
Exactly. The insulin is our first priority because it's really novel and focuses directly on neuroinflammation and trying to improve memory and attention. But there will be other options down the line as well. So we encourage. I think there's going to be a whole national recruitment effort.
Right.
To help get
the corticosteroid cortical response. We have the UK vets that had a study of Hull University over in UK. I'm not sure if you're aware of that. I might need to send you their material. But they have tests that they went through that they are trying to get us in the U.S. to look at. And one of them, which is very hard to get, if you're just trying to get answers and help, and Gulfport vets have tried, but they have the insulin stress test that they do over in the U.K., but here in the U.S., that's kind of frowned upon as being somewhat a safety problem. So I will forward you the material from the U.K. if you have not seen it, because it kind of loops in with some of that work. That you might be interested in receiving the info.
Interesting things here, too. You mentioned this in the stress response. One of the things that we've seen in the super response teams where these are the guys who are responding to the really nasty events. Suppose there's a different cortisol response and everything within the brain that when everything goes really, really bad, you've got a certain group of individuals that get really, really high functioning. In other words, everything comes together perfectly, and their ability to think clearly, to evaluate, to act, to function, everything just becomes incredibly high.
Right.
And I know from an experience, and Ray, you've been there. Ray, you've probably been there more than anybody alive because you were in the worst of the worst.
I understand what you're saying.
Wild.
Doug,
saw that on the hill, didn't you, Ray, on the ridge?
Sorry. When I work with people at Camp Lejeune, the Marines and such, I don't think they're even anyone's looking at chemical exposures and such coming back from overseas now, because they're thinking that war's over for 25 years and these guys are far from it. But we know that those exposures are still there. But they're looking at the combat, what they're looking at, and the emotional trauma of combat. And I don't think most people are not even looking at this. It's not a problem that ever went away, but to them it has, and now they've moved on, and I just don't see it a lot. And what Dr. Golier is talking about is, and Denise both, I mean, this is an area that has been kind of overlooked for a while now.
Right.
Well, do you agree with that, Doctor?
In terms of what you're referring to as the acute stress response, I mean, you want, when you're in the midst of a, sort of the situations that you're referencing, I mean, you want there to be an exaggerated stress response that focuses, that, maintains your body in a state of readiness, fight or flight, clear focus. It's critically important for survival to have intact acute stress response. It's just that after the war is over, that's no longer adaptive in the streets of the Bronx or anywhere else to be, constantly activated into this, into this heightened stress. So what's good, what might serve you well in wartime doesn't necessarily serve you well 10, 20, or 30 years later.
Right.
That is kind of the point.
But
I wasn't sure what your specific question was.
Julia, what were the implications of all the immunizations for everybody? Because we've got immunizations and everybody deployed, then we got people that got all the immunizations and they didn't deploy. Is there any consideration on how this would work into your research or what we might find or what you found already?
I That has not been my main area of inquiry, so I can't give you any real insight into that. I know it was a major concern when people came back, and it has not been as strong a signal, or maybe a signal at all, as compared to the pesticides and the pyrostigmine bromide. But again, the exposure, the research was mostly based on self-report, so it was hard to get for anyone to get accurate data on, you know, vaccines and immunizations. So that, I'm not sure anyone really has the answer to that question.
Yeah. I would refer people to the VA RAC, GWIR, and to the reports that have been done in the past from 04 to 08 to 2014 for information about mm-hmm. that. And all you have to do is Google VA RAC, GWIR,
yeah.
and refer to those studies that I think have done exceptionally well in the past with looking at immunizations.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a situation that a lot of things were combined. We all know our different exposures, even though they haven't been confirmed by the DOD. we move forward with trying to find the biomarkers, genetic problems involved in treatment. And that's what I am trying to get across to the Gulf War Vets is quit running in circles around the fig leaf tree or down the rabbit hole of exposures and accept that we are looking for biomarkers that can be used to provide us with proof, number one, if the biomarker research shows up as positive, which some of them are starting to show, and gear in on treatment trials, and as we go along and hopefully keep our funding going for CDMRP, is with the biomarkers as they develop, further testing for those, and further testing of treatment trials based on the biomarkers and see mm-hmm. if they change.
Right,
I'm, the master's degree in nursing and trying to utilize my skills that haven't been impacted totally to finding help for veterans. And, if we keep running around with the exposure without any confirmation from the DOD, it's not the VA's fault. It's DOD that did not confirm, as they did for some with Iraqi freedom veterans, that there was some exposures that they confirmed. Ours or may have been exposed were the letters that came out from Kamasia. And no, they didn't deal with other sites of weapons that were destroyed, chemical weapons. They didn't deal with the air bombing campaign. But at 25-year point, guys, it is time to quit running around on, they haven't acknowledged that. Well, they may never acknowledge that, but our scientists and our researchers are trying to find the biomarkers, the genetic clues, the changes in neurodiagnostic studies like we've been doing. And then from there, trying to find treatment trials that will help with their quality of life and provide care. A step beyond doing yoga or acupuncture, going beyond that to something more definitive. Mm-hmm. And that's what I want to get across to the veterans, the spouses. This is not being used as a guinea pig per se, people. This is trying to get us answers and get us treatment. Mm-hmm. And that will only come through this research.
And I think that also, first of all, Denise, thank you for staying so positive. I mean, you've been through a lot, and you and your whole team continue to be an inspiration to Gulf War veterans and your commitment to supporting research and getting people involved. You're really a legend, so thank you, and thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Well, I have a lot of battles with my vets because a lot of them just want to get their compensation because they're losing their families, they're losing their homes, they're financially destitute, and I do refer to that. We have groups that are working on that. I try to help with it, but that's one area. As a nurse, I want to see where can we get to that we can test people to see that they were actually, that you can have a proof in your hand, mm-hmm. and the doctors can have proof. And, you know, once you have that, you progress 100 miles ahead, mm-hmm. and much less from there to treatment trials. And, you know, I'm concerned with providing better care. And you get that through research. And I can't say
that's certainly what we're seeking to do. And, you know, because, as we started in the beginning, this has been conducted in healthy adults as well as patients with cognitive disorders. You know, we have a pretty good safety profile and pretty good understanding of
and
what people will do.
It's through this that we can look to other studies in related, closely related areas to try to find something that's out there already that can be used without having to go through FDA stage 1, 2, and 3
studies. Actually, repurposing is the buzzword. See what we can repurpose what we have.
insulin
is known anti-inflammatory. So
we need to repeat
like
the phone numbers for the vets to call if they're interested in these studies before we forget.
If you are anywhere near the Bronx in New York City or even Connecticut or New Jersey, you want to call myself, Dr. Golier, or Brendan Bichard at 718-584-9000, extension 6587. That's 718-584-9000, extension 6587. If you are in the Boston area, you'll want to contact Dr. Kringle, 857-364-6933. You can always shoot me an email about this or related topics at julia.golier, that's G-O-L-I-E-R, at va.gov. Julia.Golier at VA.gov. So our main focus is Gulf War veterans with chronic multi-symptom illness interested in treatment trials focused on improving memory and concentration. Though we also have some other studies looking at mechanism of action for which Gulf War veterans or people who served during that time who were not deployed to the Gulf can also make important contributions in our understanding of Gulf War CMI.
Well, we're
I'd
done
like
with
to also
Julia.
Mention as we close the program, Facebook page, Gulf War Illnesses, plural, Gulf War Illnesses, or you can reach me, Denise Nichols, on Facebook. And we also have a Facebook page on Gulf War Illnesses Recruitment Study.
Thank you very much, Julia. God bless you. Thank you very, very much.